Descartes, on the other hand, is saying we don't even know anything exists, even ourselves. And so he starts in the realm of knowing and then tries to prove everything through reason alone. But that shift from being, it's kind of like Aquinas, to knowing, that's Descartes of modernism. Then when they gave up on knowledge, it shifts to constructing meaning. And, you know, in that first group, in the realm of being, the most well-respected degree you could earn would be like a doctor of theology degree, because that's when the Christian worldview was the most respected. But then that gave way to modernism and deism, and so all of a sudden then a PhD in philosophy was considered, the most respectful degree to earn. But now with postmodernism, believe it or not, let me see if Sawyer says he's got a PhD, University of Missouri. It just says he taught English. I believe his PhD is actually in English. And you would say, why are we reading this guy's thought? He's not an expert in religion. He's not an expert in philosophy. He's an expert in English, and literature. But that's where postmodern, now a PhD degree in English or in literature, is the most respected thing, because now it's all about the deconstruction of text. So it's really crazy. So it's kind of like when somebody writes something, this is not what it really means. The reader has as much right. With postmodernism, there's no objective history. There's no objective author's intent, so the reader has as much right over the text as the author does. And I can't really remember if it was Richard Rorty or Jacques Derrida, but a postmodernist wrote, his thesis, which was just what I said there. And so a guy wrote a response to it and totally misrepresented what Derrida or Rorty, what they said. And it might have been even, I don't know how the French pronounce it, but it's like Leotard is the way that the guy's name is spelled. But and so he totally misrepresented what the guy said. So then he wrote, "You totally misrepresented what I meant." And so the guy replied to him, "I have as much right over your text as you do." And so the guy had basically refuted the postmodernist deconstructive ideas by basically deconstructing the postmodernist article. And then when the author complained, "You misunderstood me," he said, the guy responded and said, "No, the reader has as much right over the text, to the meaning of the text, as the author does." So this is the kind of absurdity that we're facing here, but it's kind of language and this is where political correctness is getting an awful lot of play, so that you say something like, "Well, you people," and they'll act like, and you're just talking about the people who disagree with you. You say, "Oh, so you're just clumping us all together and this and that, and you're a racist and all this other stuff." Yes, yeah, the postmodernists, that the individual, their worth is gone. It's now based on the community. On page 222, he says, worldview question number 5, "The truth about the reality itself is forever hidden from us. All we can do is tell stories." And that's real key to postmodernism. You never can get to the truth. Some postmodernists will say there is no truth. Others will say maybe there's truth, but we just can't know it. All we can know is our community's narrative of the truth. We can't know what the truth itself actually says. Worldview question number 3, page 225. "Stories give communities their cohesive character." And so basically, if you can't get at the truth, you can't get at reality, then a community has got to embrace a narrative, and that narrative will give meaning and define everything for that community. Same page, worldview questions 5 and 6. All narratives mask a play for power. Any one narrative used as a meta-narrative is oppressive. Now, this is really crazy because it's like all narratives make a play for power. So when you get the politically correct gay community or feminist community or civil rights community, they're acknowledging they're in a big power play, okay? But they think they're exempt from being marginalized or from being judged because they don't believe that their narrative is a meta-narrative. They don't believe it's a true story above all the other stories so that it can judge whether the other stories are true or not. Well, but it doesn't matter. They still treat it like it's a meta-narrative. And you know, they're going to act like, you know, and then they just scream at you. It's like J.P. Moreland said with postmodernism, if reason and truth are gone, all that's left is shouting. And that's exactly what we have. That's why if you disagree, if you teach traditional values in some way, shape, or form, or a traditional view of government, and you want to speak at Cal Berkeley, they're not going to debate you. They're going to throw rocks. Okay? They're going to riot. Page 226. Worldview question number 3. There is no substantial self. Human beings make themselves who they are by the language they construct about themselves. Now, Sire goes on to say, if this sounds like existentialism, that's because existentialism is a step in the postmodern direction. Okay? So we make ourselves by what we choose to do. And so they view the I as an activity, not as a substance. And talks about strong poets or power poets like Freud and stories that we'd like to latch onto. But in the end, though, the individual still gets swallowed up in the community. Worldview question number 6, ethics, like knowledge, is a linguistic construct. Social good is whatever society takes it to be. Again, it's cultural relativism when it comes to morality. Each culture determines what is right and what is wrong. It's really, in postmodernism, it's your community's narrative. Sire on 229, James Sire, Universe Next Door. Worldview questions 7 and 8. Postmodernism is in flux, as is postmodernism's take on the significance of human history, including its own history. This means that the core commitments of many postmodernists are in flux as well. Postmodernists, in short, are committed to an endless stream of shifting whatevers. And so it's basically, just when you think you have postmodernism nailed down, it turns out that it's just not what we thought it was because it's kind of shifted. It's kind of changed. And it's kind of, when we think of postmodernism as a worldview, it actually doesn't claim to be a worldview. It claims to be a rejection of all worldviews. But in the end, and they reject, as they reject all meta-narratives, and they reject all worldviews, they end up, and they deconstruct all other worldviews, they end up constructing their own worldview. But even the worldview that they construct with postmodernism is not robust enough to gain people's allegiance for a long enough time. So basically what I'm saying is its days are numbered. It's got to give way. It's got to give rise to something that is more, you know, an actual worldview. So you can't just have a worldview that just attacks all worldviews. Eventually it's going to give way, give rise to a full-blown worldview. You can't just say there are no absolutes. Eventually you're going to get new absolutes. Let me see if, oh yeah, right here, after existentialism, I have a couple pages on postmodernism, another way to look at it, and I think my way of explaining it is more understandable than Sayers. Yet, please remember that Sayers is much more precise. He's splitting, he's doing a much more scholar, I'm just giving a general explanation and critique of postmodernism. Sayers is being very, very precise and much more accurate. So just keep in mind, I'm speaking in general terms. But in pre-modern times, from ancient Greece through the medieval times, there were widely believed assumptions. We believe truth is absolute. Truth is that which corresponds to reality. Human reason is able to find truth. The universe makes sense. We believe in the basic reliability of the five senses, that we could find truth through the five senses, but that there's also a reality beyond the five senses, something that, you know, Plato called the world of ideals, or the world of forms. Now, the Christian world fit very nicely into the pre-modern mindset and confirmed it, because we believe that an infinite rational God created man in his image and the universe in an orderly way, so that man, created by the rational God, man is rational, that man, through human reason, could find out truth about the world in which we live. So the founders of modern science were Bible-believing Christians. But unfortunately, we got overconfident in reason. This led to modernism. René Descartes, lived from 1596 to 1650, tried to prove everything through reason alone. So he tried to find a point of certainty. He tried to doubt everything until he could find something he could no longer doubt. And the more he doubted, the more he recognized the existence of doubt, the doubter himself. And doubting is a form of thinking, so he said, I think, therefore I am. So that led to modernism, the attempt to find all truth with certainty through unaided human reason. And so, contrary to what Descartes set out to do, to prove God, it led to an argument against God, because then they thought that revelation from God is no longer needed. Okay? And, but modernism failed so miserably to find all truth. In fact, some would argue it didn't find any truth, and any truth with certainty, and didn't solve all our problems. So the reaction against modernism was postmodernism, because modernism failed to find absolute truth and solve man's problems. Postmodernism rejects absolute truth and human reason's ability to find truth. So some of the postmodern views, they deny absolute truth. They believe there's no meta-narrative. Truth is relative to one's community or social group. So they, instead of focusing on reasoning, they focus on meaning, feelings, the will. Okay, you'll see this in politics today. You'll see the postmodern candidates where facts just don't matter to them. You know, this president right now, President Trump, he's a racist. He doesn't fit with their narrative, so he's a racist. Even though he keeps making changes that have now reduced unemployment among blacks to the lowest level it has ever been. So, I mean, you can go to the 1960s, for the last 50, 60 years, black unemployment has not been this low. And so it's just feelings. It's just, you just hate the guy. And then they're trying to nail him for supposed violations of the law. Nobody's clear what the law is and what violations they're talking about. But in the meantime, it's been uncovered time and time again where the other party and the FBI have been spying on United States citizens, have been breaking law after law, have been lying, have been doing unethical things. The other party has destroyed evidence, things of that sort, but they don't care about the facts. Okay? And so the focus is on, you know, feelings, meaning, the will, and then the focus is on the community. So they're not individual relativists. They don't believe each individual determines what is right or wrong for himself. They believe each culture or each community determines what is right or what is wrong for themselves. They focus on mystery, beauty, and narratives, stories. You deny absolute truth, all that's left are telling stories, okay? They deny absolute morality, yet they put a heavy emphasis on tolerance. You gotta be tolerant. Well, that's a moral absolute then. If that's thou shalt be tolerant, well, that would be a moral absolute. But yet they reject dichotomous thinking. You know, either or type thinking. They said, no, it's just, why can't we all get along? Forget about truth or falsehood. You're an intolerant bigot if you think that way. Right and wrong. No, we reject that. Then they reduce all authority to power. Authority is when you've earned the right to be obeyed or believed. Okay? Stan Mansfield founded Shepherd's Bible College, and you got to have the academic credentials to be one of the professors. So if a guy was an auto mechanic and knows a lot about fixing cars, but has no formal training whatsoever, you're not going to see him get a job anytime soon, you know, teaching. Because you have to be able to document and prove that you have earned the right to be listened to. That would be authority. But power, forget about authority, it's just the ability to make others obey or believe. So it doesn't matter what's true or what's false. It doesn't matter what's right or what's wrong. All that matters is that you and your community have embraced a power narrative, and you have the ability to force others to obey. And so you get power narratives instead of rational arguments, okay? So if a politician can convince you he feels your pain, it's irrelevant what he does after that, okay? So power narratives instead of rational arguments. We create our own reality through language. So, you know, it's kind of like Nietzsche. He said truth is metaphor. Rather than truth being behind the symbolism and the metaphors, there's just another metaphor. And so all they can do is deconstruct language, but it's not like language points us to any reality. It's just language. Wittgenstein would call them language games. Each community has their own language game, their own narrative. And so deconstruction is popular in postmodern circles. They replace the author or speaker's meaning with meaning from their own community. So you see this in Black Christology, Marxist liberation theology, gay theology. So, you know, Jesus came to earth to free the black man, or Jesus came to earth to free the poor through Marxist communist revolution, or Jesus came to fight for gay rights. Well, that's, you know, if you ask these guys, do you really believe that that's what happened in history? They would say, no, of course not. But that's our community's narrative. Now, most postmodern thinkers are not going to come right out and say that, but they're going to say that there is no objective true history. If there is reality, if there is truth, we can never get to it. All we can get to is language behind it. Do you guys know, have you heard of Mark Driscoll?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in the late 1990s, mid to late 1990s, he kind of wanted me to be his, like, the theology teacher for his people. And so I was training his people in, like, apologetics and stuff. In fact, The God Who Sits Enthroned, he endorsed that book, but when I came out with that edition, I took his endorsement off because his thought began to move in a postmodern direction. He began to embrace the postmodern theology of Stanley Grenz. And Stanley Grenz taught that the local church community cannot really know the scriptures as they are. They can only know the scriptures through the lenses of their community's narrative. So how can the Bible, how can you be a true evangelical, a true Protestant, true traditional Protestant, who says the final authority is the Bible, if you can never get to the Bible? You can only get to what your community's narrative, how it interprets it. But there's an example of applying postmodernism to Christianity. You read the Bible, even if you read it in the original languages, Hebrew and Greek, you can't really get to the truth, the objective meaning of what it's talking about. All you're dealing with is the deconstruction of that language. Okay? And it's amazing how much of philosophy will deny what common sense will tell you, what is completely obvious, self-evident, and simple. They'll just deny that and rather embrace some long merry-go-round, big words, philosophical system of thought that takes you so far from reality that sometimes you just scratch your head and say, are these people insane? And if we're living in postmodern times, so when you turn on the news, you're thinking, are these people insane? And, so we had a guy from the Family Policy Institute of Washington State based out of Olympia. And he went to the University of Washington. He's like a 5'8" white guy. And he told them that he was telling students on the campus, what would you say if I told you that I'm Chinese? And they would stop for a second because then they have reality. They know he's not Chinese. But then they remember, I'm a college student. I'm being educated. I'm being enlightened. What are my professors teaching me? And so they would just stop, like they saw a deer in the headlights, and then they would say, if you identify as being Chinese, that's fine. And there was one guy, an African-American individual, who was like, he was a little closer to reality. He was saying, well, you don't look Chinese, you look like a white guy, but if you want to be Chinese, hey, more power to you. But you could tell this guy hadn't quite totally bought into the idea because he answered every question like that. But the next one was, he says, and what would you say if I told you that I was not only Chinese, but a female? And they'd stop and they'd say, well, if that's how you identify yourself, then you're a female. Well, this African-American individual was like, well, you don't look like a female, but, you know, whatever. If you want to call yourself a female, who am I to stop you, you know? And so he got to the point where he said he was a female, this is a 5'8" white guy, a female, 6'7" Chinese lady who is 6 years old and wants to go back to first grade, should he have the right to? Or should she have the right to? And all of them were saying, like, well, I guess so. And I can tell they're thinking about the children. But this is the garbage they're being taught. You know, I don't forget which state it was, but I think it was some kind of a gym that had membership. I don't know if it was a Y, but the lady reported there's a naked man in the ladies' locker room and he's looking at the ladies. And they checked out the guy's, figured out who he was, checked out the guy's records, and he put down that he identified as a female. So she continued to complain, so they ended up taking her membership away from her. And so that's the insanity that we have. By the way, the local YMCA, very liberal rules, but very conservative people working there, very traditional people. So the rules say that, you know, if you sign up in a certain way, you know, guys can use the ladies' room and stuff like that. But I was in the men's room, and the guy stuck his head in the door and saw me, young guy, and he went back out. And then when I came out of the restroom, I saw that he was standing there with a bunch of little boys. And once I left, he said, okay, guys, go in there, don't mess around. And he stood guard at the door. So it's kind of like, we got a policy, but over my dead body, somebody could mess with these kids, you know? And you'll see there at the Y and so where there'll be a Bible verse. That's the Christian guy who still believes why in the C of YMCA. It's still a Christian organization. But then also a quote of Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
Of some politically correct.
Those little slips that they have up at the desk because you're calling out a basket, and they'll have Christian and non-Christian.
Yeah.
Versus, now they have a kid's basket.
Wow. Well, I didn't even...
I haven't seen what's in that yet, but...
Yeah, so it's kind of... And that's the world we're in right now, and the sad thing is the more the postmodern type thought is coming about. Benjamin Weicker, he's got a book, he's a Roman Catholic thinker. He's got a book, Worshiping the State, so I bought it because I use the phrase the deification of the state. That's the direction we're going in, where we're looking to the government for everything we used to look to God and family for. And so we're no longer, you know, personally responsible. The government will give us welfare check and food stamps or whatever. And it's, I'm not talking about the people who are hurting, can't find work. I'm talking about the people who act like they're entitled to this stuff. And forget about talking to your church. We, just about every Sunday, we have someone in the church who's in need. We try to figure out how can we help them. We're not a big church, so it's not always easy for us to figure out how to help them. But we try to help. But people don't go to the church. They don't think, well, maybe I should look for a job myself. They don't go to their family. And they don't go to God. They just go directly to the state. That's what I call the deification of the state, where eventually the state's going to say, well, let's be more clear. We want you to worship us. And if you don't, we're going to get rid of you. But the disagreement I have with Benjamin Weicker is he has some problems with freedom of religion. He sees a separation of church and state, where the church is separate from the state, but in his view, the true church is the Roman Catholic Church. But he has no problem with the state submitting to the church. Whereas I agree with the Founding Fathers that in Gentile countries, there should be freedom of religion. Now, having said that, there was a time when the Europeans that were in America were like 97% Protestant. So there was a time when the Founding Fathers were questioning, should we even let Catholics come here? Because they might have their allegiance to the Pope might be greater than their allegiance to our principles of liberty. The Founding Fathers were not fond of allowing Muslims into the country. They viewed it as a violent religion. So in other words, you're free to worship as you choose, but that doesn't mean we have to allow everybody and their mother's brother into the country. And then local communities, a state could have a church state. Like some of the states, some of the colonies were Church of England. But the federal government couldn't do that. So whatever the case, Benjamin Weicker, he says that this whole trip that we've been on, modernism, deism, naturalism, you know, in the political arena, it's called liberalism. And he makes a good point. Although I view the original liberals, like the Thomas Jefferson type liberals, as pro-freedom and kind of good guys in the political arena, at least. But he views all liberalism as anti-Christian. And it almost doesn't even matter. All this stuff here, it almost doesn't even matter. The distinctions between these groups, as long as you're attacking Christianity, you're my friend. Okay? And so liberalism is anti-Christian, and, you know, at its core. And so they're opposed to Christian morality, opposed to the Christian concept of truth, opposed to the existence of the God of the Bible. And so you just see basically anti-Christian thought unfolding. And as time goes on, it becomes more clear who the enemy is. And the enemy is Christianity. So I do think he's onto something there. But it's amazing, though, because the choice really... it's not God or some brilliant worldview. When everything's said, you know, professing to be wise, they become fools. So really the choice is something closer to God or insanity. Okay? You know, it's truth or falsehood. It's right. You don't like the right, then it's wrong. Okay? If you don't want God's existence, you reject meaningful life, you accept absurdity. Brings you right back up to there. Okay? And then human life is sacred. Disposable. We didn't want that baby. Well, let's have an abortion then. It was that baby born in Great Britain just recently. I'm surprised it didn't get that much press. And the courts in Great Britain ruled that the baby had to be starved to death, even though the parents wanted it to live. Italy said they would take the baby because they're so Catholic, they're pro-life. They said they would take the baby, pay the expenses, whatever. The parents wanted to take the baby there, but there were five law enforcement officers guarding the door so that the parents couldn't even visit the baby while the baby was being starved to death. And so human life, either created in God's image, is sacred, or is disposable. And so, but the refutation of postmodernism, the statement there is no absolute truth, is self-refuting. The statement is wrong to call any action wrong is self-refuting. So they reject moral absolutes while creating new moral absolutes. You know? I mean, it's just like, you Christians are bigots, and this and that, blah, blah, blah. It's a white thing. Homosexuality is a sin. You're intolerant. How can you badmouth those gay people and this and that and all this other stuff? And it's just like, you know, and then they scream at you, don't judge others. What are they doing? They're judging us.
You saw a good example of that this week with the liberals attacking Donald Trump for calling him as 13 animals.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Fox, of course, the five, they had a liberal on there. They always do. And then they have four other guys. And they were getting in their discussion. And, you know, one of the people on there said, well, what do you call Hitler? And he wouldn't say anything. He's like, he's an animal. You know, and the other guy's like, well, you know, Stalin, what do you call him? He's an animal. And the guy's like, no, they're human beings. And he's like, are you kidding me? You know,
the
people that support MS-13 are who? The liberals.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they call them
the same people who are supporting MS-13 right now support abortion. So Hitler and Stalin, you can't call them animals because they're human beings. You can't call MS-13 gang members or terrorists, whatever they are, you can't call them animals because they're human beings. But if you want to dispose of an unborn baby, and maybe even a baby that's just been born, or maybe a disabled person like Terry Schiavo, they're okay with disposing them as if they're just an animal. So, I mean, it makes no sense at all.
Yeah, even the one MS-13 guy who got 40 years, his name was Animal.
Yeah.
You know, like, he called himself, referred to himself as that.
Yeah.
It's just crazy that...
What do you do with dangerous animals? You put them in a cage. Yeah. What do we do with MS-13 members when they commit violent crimes? We put them in cages.
Unless you're in California.
And so, yeah. So it just, if you're not going to stand up for what is right, you're going to stand up for what is wrong, you're going to back the evil. All of a sudden, the bad guy, this is like all the Che Guevara shirts. Guy's a cold-blooded murderer. He was also a racist. He hated and killed many black Cubans. He was racist against black Cubans. Yet you see him on shirts as if he's this great man of freedom nowadays. And Trump, the opposition against Trump is not because he's a full-blown conservative, because he's not. And it's not because he's a constitutionalist. He's not. The whole hit on Trump is he's not an internationalist.
Yeah.
And these anti-Christian people with a political agenda are pro-internationalism. And, now, they say that language, the postmodernist says that language does not touch reality. Well, then even their language does not touch reality. Okay? So if they can deconstruct the scriptures and anybody, what anybody else is saying, then we're allowed to deconstruct what they're saying. And so, you know, but they act like when they're communicating, there's real true ideas behind what they're saying, but what they're saying is there's no true ideas behind what anybody's saying. Well, that would include them. Okay, if every community has their own narrative, and there's no meta-narrative, no true story above all the other ones, then they cannot escape their community's narrative to critique the narrative of another community. So in other words, they're captured by their own community's narrative, and they don't have the basis. Their own community's narrative is not a meta-narrative. They wouldn't claim that it is. So how can they stand in judgment on another community's narrative? They're supposed to be cultural relativists, but they act like they're appealing to absolute truth, absolute morality, and they act like postmodernism is itself a meta-narrative. So while condemning the meta-narrative, postmodernism has become its own meta-narrative. Then they say they're against dichotomous thinking, but they themselves... Dichotomous thinking is where you divide people into two groups. So they're teaching the truth, they're teaching falsehood. They're doing the right, they're doing the wrong. Well, they divide people into two groups. Those who accept dichotomies, and them, those who don't. So they don't accept dichotomies, but they themselves are actually dichotomous. You know, so the politically correct think anybody who disagrees with them is politically incorrect, but the politically correct say there is no correct. So, they fail to give us any reason to be postmodern. Now, they say, wait a minute, I gave you numerous reasons why you should be postmodern. Okay, well then you're a modernist. Every time I give you reasons to become a Christian, you say, oh, you're just a modernist. There is reason. We have no way of knowing if reason works. Well, so they failed to give us any reason to be postmodern, because if they do give us reasons to be postmodern, they're contradicting postmodernism. While proclaiming tolerance, they cannot tolerate any non-postmodernist. So once reason is abandoned, all that's left is shouting. I got that from J.P. Moreland. And so postmodernism is a vehicle for angry people who are kind of on the margins of society. Postmodernism is a vehicle for angry people who hate tradition to attain positions of power to overturn tradition. That's probably the most important statement that I've made about postmodernism. And so what we're seeing today are angry people, whether it's transgender people or whether it's just anti-Christian people or gay people or radical feminists, whatever it may be, it's a vehicle for angry people who are on the margins of society. It's a vehicle through which angry people who hate tradition to attain positions of power to overturn tradition. And if you say, man, that doesn't make any sense, what logical reasons do you have for doing that? It's like, they look at you like, why are we even talking about logical reasons? This is my community's narrative. This is what makes me tick. And by the way, we have not seen hatred, how bad human hatred can get. With a postmodern view of tolerance, it's coming. It's just around the corner. And now, just for the Christian response to postmodernism, if you're dealing with a postmodernist, you might just need to emphasize the beauty of the redemption story. That's one thing, you know, Campus Crusade for Christ and the late Bill Bright did such a great job with millions of people to Christ, but the four spiritual laws, that might appeal to an engineer. He's looking for principles and laws. A postmodernist is looking for a story. So with a postmodernist, we might need to emphasize the beauty of the redemption story and appeal to the heart, emotions, and the will. We might need to emphasize that only in Christianity there is true community. But with the postmodernist, with the modernist, and you still get some of them around, you know, the guys, if you're studying to be an engineer or a scientist, you've got to think in modernist terms to a certain degree. We might need to emphasize the rational explanatory power of the gospel, the Christian worldview, and appeal primarily to the mind. You know, John 4:24 said, God is spirit, those who worship him worship in spirit and in truth. And spirit is that experiential side, truth is that rational side. And so I think within the realm of the Bible, the Old Testament, the Hebrew, even though they didn't throw out truth, they proclaimed truth, but there was a big emphasis on poetry, on telling narratives, on language that paints pictures with words, on community. In the Greek New Testament, analytical language like Koine Greek, it's not throwing out the narrative. It believes the gospel narrative, but the emphasis is more on truth. So I said this to Mark Driscoll back in the 1990s, we may need to change our method. In fact, he saw this handout when I was teaching his people. We may need to change our method, but we can never change the message. You know, Jesus Christ is saying yesterday, today, and forever, Hebrews 13:8, and Jude 3, we've got to contend earnestly for the faith once for all delivered to the saints. Mark Driscoll was not okay with that. So I told him, I said, okay, well, tell me what's wrong with it. Are you saying we need to change the message? And he wouldn't answer the question. But if you disagree, we may need to change our method when dealing with postmodernists, but we can never change the message. If you can't agree with that, there's something about the message that needs to go. By the way, his guys, I got sick and tired of his, he'd had 21-year-old guys that had been saved less than 6 months. You know, after I'd speak at his church or teaching some of his people, he'd take me out to eat with some of his friends, and then they would sit there and try to deconstruct me of my modernism. And I'd look at Mark, and Mark was like perfectly okay with it. So I was like, you're going to be that way, you mess with the bull, you get the horns. So Kurt Rainier was my colleague back then, now lives in Texas, great guy. And Kurt was just arguing with these guys. I let him argue with these guys for 20 minutes, but I knew he couldn't get through them. Because they were 21 years old, they had been saved for 6 months. They've been trained in postmodernism by Mark Driscoll, so they knew everything. So Kurt, God bless him, was arguing with these guys for 20 minutes, so I just let 20 minutes go by. And they were arguing, you can't defend your faith using reason and propositional truth. You basically you need to defend your faith just by telling stories. But they were arguing for that position. So I just let about 20 minutes go by, and then I dropped my fork and my knife on my plate and made a loud noise, and everybody stopped and looked at me, and I said, I haven't heard a story. You guys haven't told me a story. I want to hear a story. You're telling me I can't defend the faith by reason. I'm a modernist. That you can only defend the faith by telling stories. But you guys are not defending your religious views by telling me stories. I haven't heard any stories. You are. In fact, you guys argue like a bunch of modernists. All I'm hearing is you guys trying to reason for your position. They were so embarrassed that I think we talked about sports the rest of the night. I did it too to an Evangelical Theological Society, a professor from Multnomah. Multnomah is a pretty good school. But this one professor was on a kick. I hope he didn't stick with it. He was on a Stanley Grenz kick, and he presented a whole paper to theology professors and theology students. There's only about 30 or 40 of us there. But he presented a whole paper arguing that we should not defend our religious views by using reason, rational arguments. We should defend our religious views by telling stories. And so then he asked, are there any questions out there? I'm like the only philosopher in the room. Everybody else is a theologian or Bible scholar. Any questions? And so I raised my hand, and he called on me, and I said, how come you didn't tell me a story? He said, what? I said, how come you didn't tell me a story? You're telling me we can't defend our views by using rational arguments. That's too modernistic. We got to defend the faith by telling stories. You presented a 20-page boring paper with nothing but rational arguments. You sound like a modernist. You didn't even tell me a story. And you know what the other theologians did? Because he was a respected theologian. They're like mumbling under their breath, and I just looked around at them. I was like, okay, you know, you don't have to saw me in half. I said what I need to say. I'm just, you know, don't pick up stones, boys. You know, you want to play this little game with this Multnomah professor? Go right ahead, but homie, don't go there. You know, and I got an email on my old website from an atheist who says he listens to my stuff, watches my stuff. And he was calling me an idiot and all that. Man, I just like pumped up for the rest of the day. I was just like, man, I felt like making a hard copy of the email and taping it to me. You know, so when atheists or Satanists or Muslims are calling me names, you're calling me an idiot, call me a jerk. I mean, you see all this emotion coming out. Because they're obviously upset about something I said. And if they're upset, it probably wasn't as dumb as they claim it was. But when you get friendly fire, man, it gets old. And so, you know, after a while, there's so many Christians that sit on the bench and will throw rocks at you. And say, you should have said this, you should have said that. It's like, dude, it took you 25 minutes to say what you think I should have said when I only had 2 minutes to respond to the guy's question. Have you ever taken a debate, you know? And, but that's one thing I learned from Christian ministry is you can't fumble from the bench. You know, you got to get in the game. You got to get off the bench and off the sidelines before you even have the possibility of falling. So we make fun of Peter for denying Jesus 3 times. But that's what he's into the game.